This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Last week, you heard from technology designer and entrepreneur David Rose, who envisions a future of magical technology.
I go back to fairy tales like The Brothers Grimm or Hans Christian Andersen and think about, you know, what are those sort of magical objects that performed for people in those stories, like flying carpets or invisibility cloaks or crystal balls or like a horn or whistle that could summon help from a very long distance, or a super spyglass. And I think like these are the things that we want around us. And as technologists and as designers of things for people's lives, I'm hoping we can make more things that enchant people.
Whether it's space rockets, smartphones, or Rose's enchanted objects, engineers are the ones who actually turn magical ideas into functional reality. Those engineers work in a tightly confined space. Think about it. Designing the next wave of technologies requires innovation and risk-taking. But when it comes right down to it, the things engineers build need to work. Lives may depend on it. So how do we teach prospective engineers how to walk that tightrope? My guest today says that's one thing that America's education system does well, and he's out to share our experience with the world. Ed Crawley is the Ford Professor of Engineering at MIT and a professor of aeronautics and astronautics and of engineering systems. He helped pioneer the field of active or intelligent structures that can change in response to their environments. But recently, he's been more focused on fostering the next generation of engineers. He's director of the Bernard M. Gordon MIT Engineering Leadership Program and president of Skolkovo Institute of Science and Technology, a university in Moscow, which he founded in 2011. Ed Crawley, welcome to Living Lab.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Ed, why do you think that the way we educate engineers needs to change?
Well, I think the evidence is very strong if one talks with the people who employ the engineers we graduate. If you go around and talk to industry, large industry, small industry in the United States, around the world, representatives in government, you consistently hear the same message, which is the students we're graduating are tremendous analysts. They have great analytic capabilities. They can solve analytical problems very well. But they lack a broader set of skills and knowledge and confidence that's really necessary to be an effective engineer, an innovator, an entrepreneur. And you don't have to work hard to hear this message. If you go and engage almost any responsible representative from industry, this is more or less what they'll say.
Do you think that this is a problem or a challenge that is specific to engineering, or is this a broader issue in our education system as a whole?
Well, I think it's set in the context of a broader issue, that the disciplinarians are the dominant force in the design of university education. And disciplines are wonderful things. We need them. They develop depth. They develop new knowledge. But they aren't necessarily the unique way in which to structure the education of a young person, a young mind. There is a specific issue in engineering, which stems from the last major revolution in engineering education, which is in the 1950s and 60s. Prior to that, engineers were educated more or less to be, if you will, very, very good tradesmen. They were educated in the practice of engineering. And what happened in the 1950s and 60s, led, among other places, at MIT and Stanford, was there developed this so-called engineering science, a scientific approach to it, to the development of engineers and engineering approaches in general. And as throughout the 50s and 60s, there was a swing of the pendulum from the more practice-oriented view to the more analytical and scientifically-oriented view, which had very, very strong impact on our society. I mean, the Apollo program, the integrated circuit, these were all major inventions of the mid to late 1900s, were all invented by these engineering scientists. So this is a very important force in the evolution of education in America and around the world. What happened was that the pendulum swung a little too far. And by the 1980s or so, the students we were graduating were really mostly scientists who were then expected to be engineers. And that didn't bring the right skills and attitudes into the workforce.
You've spent most of your career at MIT, obviously one of the leading engineering schools in the country, probably the world. How much have you seen engineering education at MIT change since you were a student there in the 70s? You talk about the pendulum swinging too far by the 80s. Has it started to swing back?
Yes, it has. Actually, my career spans somewhat the beginning of the swing from engineering practice. When I was a young student at MIT, there were still professors who didn't have PhDs because they had been distinguished practitioners in industry, and they came back to the university to teach. By the time I was a graduate student or young faculty member, that generation had entirely disappeared, and the engineering scientists, the disciplinarians, were in full sway. And by the 80s or so, this view of teaching engineering by teaching science layer upon layer had become totally dominant. And actually, it was in the late 80s to early to mid-90s that the pendulum sort of swung to the far extreme and then started coming back, in part through the programs that we also helped develop at MIT about engaging students more in more authentic and active learning around tasks that are typical of engineering.
Now, you were an early contributor in the field of active or intelligent structures. First of all, what are these, and where, if anywhere, would we encounter them?
Well, this was actually in the 1980s. It was the beginning of the thing that we now call essentially the Internet of Things, the idea that you could put intelligence into things and connect with them and exchange data with them. And because I was a structures person, a structural dynamicist, I chose to start putting actuators and sensors into structures so that you could monitor their health, that you could deform them, you could reduce vibration in them. And my particular area of interest was space-based optical systems, large telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope, which will go into space in the next few years by the end of the decade, trying to build very high-precision optical systems by being able to interact with the structure and actively control its shape and vibration level.
At the institutional or community level, what would you say were the factors that enabled you as a scientist engineer to really be innovative in your research?
Well, I think that has several factors. One is the culture of MIT, like many great research universities, really encourages people to take intellectual risk. And this is really important in our society. It's really important in innovation. It's often underrated, underexamined. Innovation is, by definition, doing something new, and doing something new is, by definition, involved some amount of risk-taking. And if you live in an institutional culture, work in an institutional culture that encourages risk, you're much more likely, A, to attract people who will do this, and B, to allow them to flourish. I think, you know, great institutions in America like the Bell Labs, for example, attracted and enabled such people. I often point out, since I'm now spend a lot of time in airports with my passport in my pocket, that there is actually in the United States passport a quote by John Paul Jones that says, basically, in order to win, you have to take risk. This is really a fundamental part of the American culture and reflected in our great institutions. And I think it's actually one of the differentiators between the attitudes towards innovation in the United States versus many other countries around the world.
So how does this difference, this spectrum between being a scientist and perhaps a more practical traditional engineer play into our societal desire for and our need for innovation? Are scientists more innovative or are engineers more innovative? Or is it simply a different approach to that?
Well, first, I would never allow myself to be called a scientist because I don't do science. I do engineering. Theodore von Karman said that science is the discovery of things that have always been, and engineering is the creation of things that have never been. So I'm a creator. Scientists are discoverers. Now, in modern science, this is sort of blurring this boundary because scientists are increasingly becoming people who build new things. And I would say, speaking from the perspective of being an engineer, that once they start building new things rather than discovering what has always been, they're actually taking on the role of an engineer, if not the title of an engineer. So I have always been in the domain where you take things that you know exist, that is to say, the outputs of science, and you try to put them together like a puzzle to produce new functionality, new possibilities, new performance enabling devices, and so forth. And I did this early in my career in jet engines and turbo machine, and then for a long period of my career, as you pointed out, in intelligent structures.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Ed Crawley of MIT and also of Skolkova Institute of Science and Technology, which he founded in 2011. Ed Crawley, what was the impetus for founding Skolkova Institute of Science and Technology, or Skoltech, as it's shortened to, I guess, an entirely new engineering school in Moscow?
Well, you can view this at an international or a national level. First, I'll tell you a little bit about the national level, which is that the Russian government in the early to mid-2000s, the first decade of the century, made a very conscious decision to try and build new educational institutions and reshape their existing educational institutions. As should come to no surprise, there are still a great many very intelligent, very capable Russian students and faculty members, researchers in the Academy of Science. But there was a feeling that there wasn't a connection being made between that great, strong scientific base and the needs of society and the economy.
So they had more scientists but not enough engineers.
That would be a shorthand way of saying it, yes. More scientists and fewer innovators, I would say, fewer innovative engineers. So they did what governments actually have within their capability to do, which is only really two options. One is they tried to influence the existing educational institutions and academic institutions of the Academy of Sciences, and they tried to create a few new models of new institutions and new institutional models. And to anyone who's ever been anywhere near a university would not be surprised to find out that they're difficult places to change. Universities are sort of by organizational design a very stable form of organization. I mean, they have their origins in sort of the monastic tradition of the Middle Ages. It's a sort of a partnership of peers. And these types of organizations are very difficult to change. So they have made some progress with bringing new ideas and new approaches into the existing universities, of which there are a number of very strong ones in Russia. But in parallel, they decided to create a new economic zone, a new innovation center outside of Russia, outside of Moscow, called Skolkova. And the myth that we've agreed to is at the center of any one of these successful innovation zones, Greater Boston, Cambridge in the UK, Palo Alto and Austin, Texas, that there is a great technical university. So they went on a deliberate tour of the existing universities of this flavor, including MIT, including Stanford and Imperial College London, ETH Zurich, to see how they operate and to determine whether any of these universities would be interested in helping co-found this new institution in Moscow. MIT decided that it was interested in this, and it came to pass after a year or so of negotiation that MIT entered into a partnership to develop this new academic institution, and I was asked to be the founding president.
Now, government relations between the United States and Russia have been rocky and, if anything, deteriorating in recent years. Has this project met with political support, or has there been some pushback about this level of collaboration?
No, by and large, there's very strong political support actually on both sides. It's generally understood in the academic world, and I think in the government world, that there are a few classes of things that countries should continue to work on together regardless of the larger political condition. Exchange of culture, sport, education, science, and down to some practical things like air traffic control and telecommunications. I mean, no one's cutting off phone lines or preventing jets from flying to Russia these days. Mike McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Moscow who just came home this spring, who's a professor at Stanford, has a nice metaphor that I like to use, which is when he was ambassador, he used to say that my job is to put ballast in the bottom of the boat because the seas of relationships between great powers like Russia and the United States will at some times become turbulent. And it's necessary to have programs, joint approaches, interactions that are basically ballast to stabilize this relationship. And I think projects like ours, like Skolkovo, are really part of this effort to maintain a continuity of dialogue around rather neutral things, education and science and engineering, at a time when there's actually some significant stress in the relationship.
Now, the space race, going back to tensions, historic tensions between the U.S. and the then Soviet Union, I mean, the space race, Cold War competition was really what drove, to some degree, innovation in this country for decades. Does this university and this new academic relationship in some way kind of close the loop on that that chapter in our history?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I myself am a product of the space race. I was in high school in the 60s and early 70s. I benefited from the post-Sputnik era investment in the United States in language. I studied Russian in high school and then again at university at MIT. So I had started to anticipate that at some point I would be able to participate in this race or this collaboration with the then Soviets in space. And it was a tremendous driver of innovation in a positive sense, that it wasn't an arms race. It wasn't about taking over territories or countries. It was about proving that your society has enormous technological capability in a rather peaceful way. I don't think we'll see that again in the near future. I think that we've moved to a time of collaboration in many of these large scientific endeavors. I mean, unaffected by the current state of political affairs between the United States and the Russian Federation is the fact that our astronauts fly up and down together to the space station, work together on the space station, plan scientific missions of discovery together. These are specifically exempted from the general policy that prohibits collaboration on the part of government agencies with the Russians. So, you know, it's an interesting mixed bag that in this time of real competition, you get this drive, but in a time of collaboration, you get access to this new network of knowledge and collaborators.
That's Ed Crowley, founder and president of Skolkovo Institute of Science and Technology, a new university in Moscow designed to educate engineers and foster innovation. We'll talk more about how the university does that in just a few moments. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest, Dr. Ed Crowley, is a professor of aeronautics and astronautics and of engineering systems at MIT. These days, he's spending less time building high-tech structures and more time designing and implementing educational systems that foster innovation. He's lead author of a recent book, Rethinking Engineering Education, The CDIO Approach. Ed Crowley, what is the CDIO approach to engineering education?
Well, first, the letters CDIO stand for Conceive, Design, Implement, and Operate. It's the life cycle of the product or system that engineers build. And we chose this to remind ourselves that this is the context in which we should be educating engineers. We should be educating engineers to work in this life cycle of identifying the needs of society, designing things, building them, and then operating them so that their value is delivered, their impact occurs. And you have to say, well, this is such an obvious statement. Why isn't everybody realized that this is the way to educate engineers? Well, you have to go back to the idea that engineering science became the paradigm by the 1970s and 1980s, a very reductionist approach to educating engineers. And this is a more synthetic approach to educating engineers that gives them, in addition to the disciplinary knowledge, which is vital, gives them skills in how to work together, how to think in modes of thinking other than just analytic thinking, how to design and build things, this broader set of professional skills that are necessary for the preparation of an effective engineer.
So what does that look like in practice, say, at your new university in Moscow, Skoltech?
Well, let me tell you how it looks in general. What it does is CDIO was actually designed as an approach to undergraduate engineering education. So the first observation is that we should actually get students building things from the very first day they're at university. We sort of reject the notion that you have to learn layer upon layer of engineering science before you can design and build anything. So we get students building relatively simple things, but things that are technical in nature from the very beginning. What that does is it gives them the experiences so that when they encounter the, frankly, deadly theory, the months and years of studying all the sorts of things that people ridicule engineering students at most universities for spending all night studying, when they encounter that tough body of knowledge, they know why they're learning it. It's motivational. It provides structure to knowledge. It allows them to integrate ideas because they've had the experience of trying to build some things already. And then later in the undergraduate education, there are one or potentially two more cycles of then taking the knowledge that they've gained and applying it to the building of something. So what this does is it, one, motivates them. It allows them to do the authentic activities of an engineer early in their education. Two, it helps support their learning of the technical fundamentals. And three, it actually gives them the broader set of skills and knowledge that an engineer needs and, frankly, most effective members of society need, the ability to communicate effectively, work in teams, reason critically, and so forth, plus the special skills of design and construction in an engineering sense.
How you mentioned earlier the fact that engineering should be producing new technologies and the need for innovation, and that inherently requires risk and potentially failure. On the other hand, you have the fact that when an engineer produces something like, say, a bridge or a spaceship, it has to work. There are potentially fatal consequences if they fail. How do you balance those two in teaching engineers their craft?
Well, you know, we have an expression in the space business, one strike and you're out. You know, that you only have one opportunity to launch the rocket, one opportunity to turn on the spacecraft in space, one opportunity for the humans to set foot on the moon. So we're very, very conscious of making sure that there's assurance that the performance and functionality that we design into a system really does materialize when it's fielded. But that doesn't mean that in the development process you aren't willing and obliged, in fact, to take some risks, to pursue designs that have never been pursued before, to develop materials or algorithms and use them in a device in ways they've never been used before, or in fact invent them for purpose. So the risk in engineering that is allowed and encouraged is in the, if you will, the creative process of design and synthesis. But once you build that system, then there's this very intense pressure, at least in the space community. You can judge for yourself about consumer software, for example. But in the space community, there's a very strong motivation to make sure it works on time every time.
Now, it's at Skoltech, there are five priority areas that for education and research, both biomedicine, information technology, the software you're just talking about, space, which you've mentioned, energy and nuclear energy. But the intention, as I understand it, is to break away from the traditional model of having departments. So why is that, and how do you accomplish that?
Well, we accomplish that by not having departments.
That would be the simple answer.
Right. You know, people are hired to the faculty, and they become a professor of Skoltech, and they work on whatever they want to work on. Now, of course, because we hired them, they are hired because they have an interest in, as you mentioned, the list, space or biomedicine or energy, so forth. But the strength of the disciplinary tradition that has evolved in the last 100 years or so in higher education is such that in traditional structures of universities, more or less throughout the world, the departments are more or less centered around a discipline. And the battle cry of the last 20 or 30 years is we need more interdisciplinary work. Well, this is really in some sense code for we need people to be able to flexibly move across the boundaries not only of their discipline but of their organizational unit. And in fact, in the career of a young scholar, a young professor, it's actually somewhat dangerous to be in this zone between disciplines, because when it comes time to have reviews for promotion and tenure, you're judged by the disciplinarians on one side or the other side or both of that boundary, and it can be a very lonely spot unless you're fantastically successful, in which case everyone will recognize your capability. So if you just don't have organizations like this, then there's no disciplines and then there's no interdisciplines and then there's no risk of being at the edge of a discipline. It's all what I like to call post-disciplinary. It just has a different organizational scheme than disciplines, which doesn't mean that each of us individually doesn't apply the disciplines we've learned. It's just the organization is designed to encourage the behavior we hope for, which is people working together across disciplines, across conventional disciplines, in order to approach problems. I once gave a lecture at Cambridge University about a decade ago, and at the end, one of my colleagues tried to summarize my comments by saying, you know, at MIT, you solve problems, and at Cambridge, we have disciplines. It's the orientation of higher education towards solving the problems of society that I think is the way in which universities are going to be able to have their greatest impact in the 21st century.
Well, we all, I think, at this point, scientists and non-scientists, live in a world of information overload. As you ask engineers to expand the breadth of their knowledge, do you risk losing depth of understanding? And is there a risk inherent in asking people to be this interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary?
No.
Not at all.
No, there isn't. No, there isn't. Not if the education is well designed. Education is not a data transmission process with a maximum baud rate that you can accomplish. That's the model that many people have in their mind. If you have to teach X more of X, you have to teach less of Y. You really need to think of it more as an integrated model where you can teach engineering while teaching communication. You can teach science while teaching group interaction. You can teach design while teaching thermodynamics. And in fact, incorporating knowledge into a more genuine social structure of interaction it enables people to learn more knowledge. So it's actually at least break even. That is to say, that you don't have to omit things from the education, that you can weave in these other views. Now, if you have to actually learn two disciplines, if you have to learn biology and chemistry to do your job, or if you're going to get an MD and a PhD, as many people in Greater Boston do in the university systems and hospital systems, well, then it does take more time. But to learn the broader set of skills and a discipline, I think can be done easily in the same amount of time as learning the discipline with a well-designed education. And that's what the principles, the standards of good practice that are embedded in the CDIO approach lead you to when you're laying out a new educational scheme.
As you described the impetus for founding Skoltech, it sounded an awful lot like we've learned a lot about how to innovate and we're going to help Russia with that. But this year, you started an exchange program with MIT where MIT students are actually going to Russia. What do you expect them to get out of their experience at Skoltech?
Well, you have to think a little bit about the design of Skoltech. Skoltech is a university, a new university, designed to sit in the context of the Russian higher education system, which has really superb traditional universities of science and technology. So the students that come out of that, like the students who come out of, say, an undergraduate program at MIT or another fine American research-intensive university, have a very strong disciplinary background. At Skoltech, innovation is not the third mission, as some people place it. Innovation is not the second mission, as some people place it. Innovation is the first mission, a along with research and education. We designed the educational system at Skoltek specifically in order to strengthen the innovative capability and the innovative inclination of the students who go there. So, for example, when students arrive at Skoltek, they get a month-long intensive experience in innovation before they ever see a formula about energy conversion or space travel, or before they ever do a biology experiment. They learn how to innovate working with other members of their class. And the influence this has on their future development is really very, very significant. It makes a very strong cultural statement, right? That you only get one chance to make a first impression, and the first impression we're going to have you learn about is how to be an innovator. In the design of our buildings, you'll walk by the innovation center and the innovation zone on the way to your biology lab or your chemistry lab. That spread throughout the courses that the students take are a backbone of courses about innovation. Then in the January special short term in January, they're encouraged to do innovative projects. And in fact, at the end of each of our terms, there's what we call an app period, an application period, where we specifically take the material that the student has learned in the previous 8 weeks, their 8 week terms, in the previous 8 weeks, and have them apply it immediately so that the students learn and really internalize the useful nature of the material that they've just absorbed. One of the principles of William Barton Rogers, the founder of MIT, was an education in useful knowledge. That is to say that not all, but some subset of the people who are university graduates should have this specific orientation of taking knowledge and applying it in a useful way for society.
I mean, that sounds like a really exciting environment for young students to be in. The skeptic in me, though, has to wonder whether or not students, researchers, engineers in Russia have the true academic and intellectual freedom that they need to be able to fully pursue that kind of innovation.
Well, of course, that's a complex question, but I would say that I haven't seen any evidence to the contrary, and I've lived now in Moscow for 3 years. Without getting into the politics of the situation, where on the boundaries and in the popular media and so forth, there may or may not be an attempt to influence people's thinking, as there is, I believe, now in most media coverage, with the exception of this show, of course. The fact is that if you go to a Russian university, a Russian academic institution, the equivalent of our government labs in the United States, you find very bright, highly motivated, very capable people there who are working on very important scientific problems, that many of which are oriented towards addressing issues of society, infectious diseases, telecommunication, and so forth. And I haven't encountered any evidence whatsoever of any attempt by the government or any third party to influence the scientific course of that investigation and that discourse. Unfortunately, for example, in early August, only for the second time in the history of the meeting, it was the Russians' turn to host the international meeting, the Committee on Space Research, COSPAR. And there were thousands of people there, and unfortunately not many Americans. So there is some influence about these limitations, but it may not be popping up exactly where you would anticipate.
You're listening to Living Lab. My conversation with Ed Crawley, founder and president of Skolkova Institute of Science and Technology, continues in a moment. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Ed Crawley, Ford Professor of Engineering at MIT and founder and president of Skolkova Institute of Science and Technology. Skoltek, as it's called, isn't his first venture into international collaborations in the innovation space. From 2003 to 2006, he served as the executive director of the Cambridge MIT Institute, a joint venture with Cambridge University funded by the British government and industry. Ed Crawley, what was the goal of that program?
Well, ironically, the goal of that program was actually very similar to the current one in Moscow. The Russians and the British actually share a feature of their societies, of their scientific establishments, which is that they have very strong fundamental science and research in terms of Nobel Prizes won, citations, these traditional measures of scientific output. But between their scientific base and their industry, there's a big leak in the pipeline that somehow or another, because of the way things work, the scientific ideas don't flow smoothly into industry, as I think they do much better in the United States or, for example, in Germany, where there's a whole system of various types of centers and labs and organizations whose role it is to move technology along towards impact on products and systems. So this was a request by the British government in the days of New Labour in the late 1990s to come and have MIT work with, in this case, an existing institution, Cambridge University, a fabulous place, a wonderful center of learning, to have it, if you will, take on a little more of the character of an American research university in the area of innovation. How do you encourage the professors? How do you motivate the students to look outside of the university more and look towards application of their knowledge and research with a consideration of use?
We tend to hear a lot about the deficits of the American education system, how our students are underperforming compared to students in other nations, particularly in the math and science realm. But you're talking about sharing our expertise, essentially, in science and technology education with the rest of the world. How do you reconcile those two?
Well, I think that the perception of the deficit in the American educational system is primarily in K-12, which is a very complex issue of which I'm not an expert by any means. It's in the K-12 years that you see reports of, you know, math scores not in the top 20 in the world, scientific background not highly ranked, and so forth.
But how would you recover from those deficits in the K-12 years to go on to be an internationally innovative engineer? I mean, that doesn't seem to make sense if our students are coming out of high school behind and ending up ahead 4 years later.
It doesn't. But there's two things that happen. One is that I really do believe that the university systems in the United States is one of the great strengths of the nation and is the envy of much of the world, frankly. But it's also true that the average student coming out of K-12 doesn't go to engineering school or science school. And the students who come out of the secondary education system, grade 12, going to university in science and engineering tend to be the ones that have either been selected or self-selected for a specific capability in science and mathematics. And that subset of the population is actually very strong. So to a certain extent, there is an area that we could improve in secondary education in America in the teaching of science and mathematics. But in some sense, there's a little bit of statistical misapplication here that would imply that the feedstock going into the great research universities of America is not as good as it is elsewhere, which is not the case. The students who enter the great research universities in science and mathematics in America are pretty well prepared by any international standards, except perhaps for the French, who really do a superb job of that.
Are the programs that you've been involved in, both with Cambridge and now with Skoltech, in a one-sided endeavor where we are sharing our expertise in innovation and helping these other countries raise their standard in terms of innovation? Or is there also a mutual benefit, something that feeds back to MIT and to American students and engineers?
No, I think there's definitely something that feeds back. First, I would say that science has a 4,000 or 5,000 year tradition of being international, right? Science and the way we educate students is just really one of the first multinational endeavors that humans took part in. There's clearly feedback that none of the institutions in America, some of whom are building campuses in East Asia, some of whom are starting programs in Western Europe, in the Middle East, none of them would be doing these things if there wasn't some significant organizational gain. I would say in the Cambridge experience, for example, the relationship between MIT and Cambridge University in the UK, there was a result of the interaction, a very deep introspection that occurred at MIT about the way we educate students. That when the Cambridge students started coming to MIT and were really, really fabulously well prepared by the standards of the students they mixed with in, at the university level of education, university level of schooling, people started saying, what are these Cambridge students, how did these Cambridge students get to be so good? I mean, they're intelligent students just like the MIT students are intelligent. And we looked into the tutorial system, the examination system, the process in Cambridge University, like Oxford and other few other great British universities, of placing the responsibility of learning and of integrating knowledge squarely on the shoulders of the students at a very young age. So this had very significant impact, for example, at MIT. I think in the case of Skoltek, it's still early. It's we're only not quite yet 3 years into the program. But the exposure that's come to MIT, the deep working knowledge of the strengths of the Russian educational and academic research system gives MIT for the next 10 or 20 years a network into a place of great scholarship that it would not have had had it not been for this relationship with Skoltek.
It's perhaps a high-level version of the old adage that the best way to learn is to teach.
Well, that's right. But and another good way to learn and develop good students is to network. And you know, what MIT will benefit from is this extensive network that it will build in, or is building in Russia.
You mentioned the very long history of science as an international endeavor. In today's globalized world, electronic communications, is international collaboration more important than ever? And is that particularly true in engineering, do you think?
Well, it's probably more important and simultaneously inevitable. I recently was talking with a colleague who was a vice president for international affairs at a British university who said that they had tracked the number of paper or the percentage of papers, journal articles written by their faculty that had a foreign author, that is to say a non-UK author in this case, that had gone from something like 20% to 40% in a decade. I mean, this is a very rapid change in behavior by university standards. So there are so many more opportunities to interact internationally. There's so much easier to interact internationally by Skyping and sending documents and chatting and so forth. I mean, things that regular people do, but scholars do at least as intensely about their scholarship, that it's simultaneously more important and easier to do. And I think you're seeing that the networking that's going on internationally is really phenomenal. And there's no end in sight. I mean, the institutions themselves, the universities, tend to be still primarily domestic. But the people who work at them, the scholars, the students, are increasingly internationalized.
We've touched on this in a few different ways by the space race and the competition and collaboration that came out of that at an international level, also at a much smaller scale within departments or when you eliminate departments, interdepartmental and truly interdisciplinary work. Where do you find the balance between the synergies that come from collaboration and the motivational force that comes from competition, particularly when you are trying to innovate and really be at the cutting edge of technology?
Well, for all I've said about the desire of people to collaborate, there is still amongst most scholars, engineers, scientists, a personal drive to excel, to discover new knowledge, to create things first, and to be personally involved in that. I mean, that's the reward, if you will, of being a scholar in the modern age. And I don't think we have to work consciously very hard to keep that balance. I think that that's the type of people who are attracted to science and engineering and to technology. And the fact that they collaborate as a mechanism for discovery and new development is just a new wrinkle on an old approach, on an old paradigm, which is that the people who are successful at this are widely regarded by their peers, and that's the ultimate congratulatory phase of one's career.
You have won multiple teaching awards in addition to being a very innovative and renowned researcher. What do you think makes you such an excellent teacher and draws students to your teaching style?
Well, first I'll contest the hypothesis of your question. about 25 years ago, MIT created a new class of faculty awards called the Faculty Fellow, the Margaret McVicar Faculty Fellow, to recognize the strong teachers at MIT. And the going-in assumption was that people would either gravitate in their career towards getting a chair for research, or they would gravitate towards this faculty fellowship to recognize teaching. And after a few years, the provost noticed a pattern, which is that these faculty fellowships were going to the people who also had distinguished chairs. That is to say, you know, if you work intensively and if you love your work and if you really want to be at a university, you work hard on your research and you work hard on your teaching. At least that's the culture of a place like MIT. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that I enjoy doing my scientific work, but I love working with students, and that's the fact of it. You know, I think I'm an effective teacher because I actually enjoy helping young people learn things. I'm the president of a university, and I taught a class this morning from MIT to Moscow, by the way, because I wasn't able to be in the class that I'm teaching this semester there this morning. My wife, who is an acute observer of my behavior, will often say to me over breakfast, so Ed, you're teaching a class today, right? And I will look at her and say, how do you know? And she says, well, you're always happier in the morning when you're going to teach.
I love that. Ed Crawley, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Ed Crawley is president of Skolkova Institute of Science and Technology, director of the Bernard M. Gordon MIT Engineering Leadership Program, and the Ford Professor of Engineering at MIT. And that's our show for today. Tune in next week for a preview of WCAI's upcoming in-depth series about the future of New England's energy system.
I think natural gas will dominate the next 50, 60 years. What that involves for New England is building of pipelines, mainly from Pennsylvania.
Fossil fuels have to go. We can no longer rely on them because they are ruining the world. So the sooner we abolish them, the better off we are. And we have to replace them with renewable energy.
If you have a suite of resources, it's just like, you know, building your financial portfolio, and you want diversity, you want geographic diversity, you want economic diversity. It's the same concept.
Also, naturalist and author Bill Sargent talks about his new book, Islands in the Storm. It's a look at island communities facing the challenges of sea level rise and erosion. And don't forget to check out Living Lab Radio on social media. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or on Instagram. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.